Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It's the Preachers and Sneakers podcast, the podcast that literally no one ever asked for, and I keep making them because I do what I want, my people. Today, I sat down and talked with my good buddy, Ben Satterly. Ben's a professional drummer over in Nashville, and we connected over Instagram over our mutual love of drums, but we got into some really interesting topics regarding prosperity gospel, celebrity church culture, a little bit of mental health, a little bit of parenting. There's a lot of good stuff in here for everybody. So I hope you get something out of it. I know I got a ton out of it. And if you don't care about drums, fast forward. We talk about music for a while, but eventually we get into some pretty meaty stuff, which I think you'll enjoy. If you haven't already, make sure you head on over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating for the podcast. If you love it, if you hate it, leave a rating too. It's helpful for me to improve the content. Also, if you haven't checked out our Patreon yet, go to patreon.com/preachersandsneakers. You get exclusive content, you get exclusive merch, a lot of awesome things going on over there. So, hope you enjoy my conversation with Ben and talk to you later. All right, well, let's kick this. So I'm talking to my homie, Ben Satterly, who is a full-time drummer over in Nashville. And you and I got connected early on when this account started to blow up, mostly because you reached out to me, but I was drawn to you because you had some dope drumming videos. And I grew up a drummer, really interested in drums, and I think it's the best instrument out there. And but through our conversations, you had some good takes about materialism and celebrity church culture and preachers and sneakers. So before we get into that, you mind walking me through kind of what your drumming careers looked like in kind of a quick form? I know there's a lot here. I mean, you gig all over the world. You do tons of volume in regards to gigs. So quickly go through how you got to where you are currently, what you're up to today, and we'll go from there.
So I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My mom and I moved there when I was a little baby so she could go to Bible school. And I grew up in the church at a time that was really, really healthy for just the church as a whole because it was much more locally based. And I mean, this is pre-internet, so you didn't really have a lot of ways to connect with the corporate church as a whole. You know, you would see concerts and stuff. I mean, Carmen was based out of Tulsa at the time, and he was huge.
Oh yeah,
he was
one of the first contemporary church celebrities, right? Or Christian celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could definitely say that because he wasn't just a worship leader; he was just like a Christian icon at that point,
right?
Doing solo stadium shows. I mean, at a time when really only Garth Brooks was doing that, and doing that, just asking for a love offering, which was great for a poor kid like me. So,
is he still around?
As far as I know, he's still doing his thing. He kind of went away for a bit, and I guess he had a cancer scare. I guess he's back. I guess he was healed, and he's back doing his thing. I mean, it's definitely not the same scale, but I think he's also, you know, he's getting up there, man. He's got to be in his mid to late 60s.
Yeah, born 1956, and now he's a television host and evangelist, apparently.
Yeah, which, I mean, is a little bit more.
How his sneaker game is.
Oh, dude, I mean, he was always a really sharp dresser. one of my mom's really close friends when I was growing up, this lady named Miss Rosemary, was actually his cousin. So she would always, like, rag on him and give him all these, like, you know, really, really behind-the-scenes intimate stories about growing up together in New York. And, yeah.
Interesting.
Good stuff. But
so you're from Tulsa, home of Christian radio stations and the Hard Rock Tulsa. I don't know much else about Tulsa.
Oral Roberts University, as far as like the church is concerned, is probably like the most famous thing out of Tulsa right now.
Okay.
And I grew up.
Is Oral Roberts from there?
I don't think so. But he founded that church, I think, he founded that school in the 70s, I want to say. And I grew up like a mile from there. And that was, I mean, I was real fortunate, not only just growing up in the church and experiencing a lot of different stuff growing up, but also, you know, I was exposed to music really, really young. My mother was a drummer. My father was a drummer. And I was
just
my mom. Yeah. I mean, I was real fortunate. You know, she got me a practice pad in pair of sticks when I was, I think, 4 or 5. And, I started kind of fiddling around, with drums, but I didn't actually get a set of drums until I was about 12 years old. And the story goes, basically, we were at a barbershop, and this guy met me and my mom, and he was like, "Oh, you're a drummer?" And I was like, "Well, not really, but I really like drums." And cut to about a month later, he shows up at my house with a heavily, heavily used drum kit. Had some dude's laundry in it. It smelled awful. But man, I cherished that drum kit. I had it and I played on it for maybe about 2 or 3 years before I was able to get like a quote unquote legit kit.
Do you remember what kind it was?
It was a Percussion Plus kit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's like a off-brand type deal.
It's the off-brand of the off-brand. Yeah. It's like, you know how like you have, Mr. Pibb is like the ghetto Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
This would be like Dr. Thunder.
But it is delicious.
Which is like, yeah, no, it's, oh, man, I can't taste the difference. But yeah, like Dr. Thunder is like the Dollar General version of that.
Right.
That's what percussion
is. But when you're that age, you don't care if it's a drum set. And you're like,
dude, I did not care at all. Oh, man, I was in heaven, bro. Are you kidding me? And like, I'd literally been dreaming of a drum kit, praying for a drum kit. So when I got one, I did not care at all that it was a piece, man. I loved that thing.
Did you find that you could like have some chops from the very beginning, or did your parents have to teach you from the get-go?
No,
or your mom had to teach you from the get-go?
I sucked. no. And my mom, she marched snare line. So although she had like hands, she never did anything with like four-way coordination. So I kind of was on my own. There was two drummers I really looked up to at the church. One was this dude named Jason Burrell. And the other one was my homie Edison Hill, who I'm still good friends with. Shout out to Edison. What's up, dude? And man, what's so funny, man, he was the guy that I would bug when I was little, because he was the first drummer at the church I remember. And I go, "Mr. Edison, can I please play the drums?" And he's like, "Man, get out of here, kid." And what's funny is that now, you know, he's got grown kids of his own. He's still very much kind of like a big brother to me. And I love that dude a lot. He, you know, him and Jason, and this other dude named Arthur Thompson, who was my mentor, like later on, in Tulsa, they all did a lot of really, positive things to speak life into what I was doing, tried to, you know, aim me in the right directions and teach me what to do and what not to do, especially in the context of, playing in church.
Hmm. Like, don't do a bunch of fills during worship song.
Oh, no, no. I went to a black church. Fills were very much okay.
Oh. gospel chops only, then.
Oh, bro. And like, that was the thing. I never really had gospel chops. So, like, I thought I sucked. Because in the black church, you really got to be able to play beyond just pocket. I mean, don't get me wrong, pockets definitely, you have to have that, but also you got to be able to play out. And I never was able to do that, which might have been the reason why I felt so at home kind of playing some of the I guess you would say like more like CCM, like wider churches, because it wasn't necessarily more chops driven. It was more just like emphasizing the groove. And exactly, which was, always kind of what I felt in my heart like I wanted to do anyways.
Yeah, interesting. For those listening that don't know what pocket is, basically the ability to stay in the rhythm to the point where it's like that's your whole role as a drummer, really, is to like quote unquote stay in the pocket and do fills, as required. But gospel chops on the other hand is being all over the place, but somehow it fits in the context of the beat, right? How would you
exactly? No, I mean, what you said was perfect, and it's being able to at the drop of a hat be able to go from one section to another seamlessly, fluidly. And like I'm not saying it to rag. It's just it's not my style. Like some dudes really dig the AC/DC vibe, bum, da na na. Where it's just 2 and 4, and like that dude made millions of dollars doing that. I don't fault him at all. At the same time, when you see somebody who's playing for like a band like maybe Rush, Neil Peart, that dude's incredible rock icon. I couldn't do that either. You know what I mean? And so like both are, it's like separate but equal. Like I really dig the AC/DC thing. I really dig the Rush thing. Both are great. It's just, it's apples and oranges.
Yeah. And when you're coming up, a lot of times you want to work on the sexy stuff that maybe leans more towards gospel chops.
But if
if you don't get a bass, then you just kind of end up being that guy that's doing too much, like do less and God bless.
And when I started gigging, that's when I really started to get hip to the fact that like people were like, no, just give me that pocket. I was playing with this dude at the time. He was from Alabama, so he was real slick. He's like, man, you give me that pocket, boy, man, just lay it back there, blah. And he would always talk, he wanted the snare to sound like a gunshot. He's like, man, just give me that pat, just give me that. Like he was so funny. But and then when I started doing other stuff, I started gigging, because at the time I was at a church that had probably at least 6 other drummers, at least, other than me and Edison and Jason, who all were like down to play, so I mean I was the youngest, so I wasn't getting any love. I wasn't getting to play. I was just bugging the worship pastor way too much. So I started gigging out. I was playing with the steel drum band. I was playing, doing jazz clubs. There was this really great jazz club back in Tulsa, which I don't think it's there anymore, called the Continental. It was very much built like the long New York style skinny clubs.
Yeah. Underground. You know what I
mean? Yeah. Yeah. It was built like that. And I started going there when I was, oh man, see, I've never been to a New York club ever. Like, but they were like, yeah,
they're still around, but it's like a lot of times they get so full so quickly. Like they'll start playing at like 6 or 7 and they'll already be full because it's like a thing now. I mean, maybe it's always been a thing, but it's cool to be able to go experience like old school jazz club. And a lot of people pack those places out.
Well, and every time I've been to New York, I've never been able to have freedom at nighttime. I've always been gigging. So like, I'd love to go to like the 55 bar or something like that, the Bitter End, one of those places. Cause I mean, some of the most amazing musicians in New York will go and play there for like, an hour or two for 50 people, but
yeah. So were you working? I mean, so what age is this that you're playing in jazz clubs? Like jazz isn't easy. Like that's, to me, 16. That's one of the harder forms out there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was in jazz band at the time, and my band instructor, Mr. Kirk, was very much like a Mr. Miyagi type dude, in Karate Kid, where he's teaching Daniel all that crap without actually like letting him know he's learning. That was how he, I'd be playing a song and he'd be like, hey, Ben, why don't you go check out Philly Joe? And then he would just count the song off again. And I'm like, who the frick is Philly Joe? Like, what does this mean? So he would just give me basically the shovel, and then I'd have to go dig for what the frick he was talking about. And so I'd come back a week later going, hey, I get it. Did you mean this? He's like, there you go. And like, that was it. So I found I really benefited well from that type of teaching.
Yeah.
And man, it was really cool to get to be able to do gigging like that. So I started gigging in clubs. I would go in there, and they knew I was underage, but I never tried to drink or anything like that. Like I, mm-hmm. so I was cool, you know. But yeah, I'd go sit in at the jam nights and just try to learn as much as I could from the older guys.
That's interesting. So that mostly was Tulsa based. Did you find that you were able to excel beyond your peers for your age, like as a drummer, or did you find that you had a lot of peers that were doing a lot of the same things as you, or you stand out?
I would say, although I showed some talent, my main thing that had me stand out was my drive. It wasn't that I was necessarily better. It was that I was way more hungry to learn and to continue to improve. A lot of my homies kind of like, you know, I guess that you would say they fell away. You know, they went to high school and started doing, they were getting degrees in like real jobs, man. Like they're, you know,
yeah.
And where I was like, no, you know, cause I got accepted to Berkeley out of high school. And then about a month before I was supposed to go, I had a really serious panic attack. I felt like I wasn't supposed to go. Like I wasn't emotional.
Berklee College of Music.
Yes. Yeah, the one in Boston. Yeah.
Yeah. So you had a panic attack because.
I just felt like I wasn't supposed to, I wasn't ready to go. Like I wasn't ready to leave, you know? Hmm. And my mom was like, all right, well, I'm moving to Texas. So I guess you're just gonna have to get an apartment and stay here. I was like, all right then. And that's what I did.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
that's one of the hardest music schools to get into.
Yeah, it was a rough one. And then, you know, when I auditioned, man, I was kind of hoping they were going to have a non-drummer audition me. And instead they had this guy named Ralph Peterson, who's not only is he a world-class jazz drummer, but he is also a phenomenal trumpet player and piano player. So he really knew his crap and he could tell that I didn't know mine. So although he was very kind and he gave me some, you know, some nice words to learn from, I got accepted, but I didn't get much scholarship. So that was another thing. I was going to be like $150,000 in debt for a little piece of paper that said I could play. So
woof.
I decided to stay in Tulsa and just throw myself in the deepest water I could find. So that meant playing with the American Theater Company, doing, you know, pit work for them, for productions. I was doing jazz trio, Latin jazz, steel drum band, funk band, top 40 rock band, 90s cover band. I mean, anything I could get my hands on, anything I could do to work is what I did.
That's bananas. And were you booking yourself the whole time?
Oh, yeah, bro. You know, it's funny. I look back now at like how I would schedule. I would schedule 2 and 3 months in advance. And then like if I was doing this thing at the time with this artist from Missouri, we do those CIY camps, Christ in Youth. I think it's more of like a Midwestern thing. But basically what would happen is we would go and play like Thursday through Sunday at a church camp. So like one was in Missouri, one was in Scranton, Pennsylvania, one was like in Memphis, and it was like at colleges, but it was all middle school, high school kids.
Interesting. So kind of like student life or DNOW.
Exactly. Type conference. Yeah. Like a mini version of YWAM, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But you know, it was great. And like that kind of got me into playing with a worship artist who, because at this time, there wasn't a lot known about how Hillsong worked as far as like, okay, they're using click and loop, and there's probably also, you know, vocal prompts in your ear so you know where you're at. And so like that was all new to me, and it was an amazing experience for me to be able to grow and like learn about how to play along with something like that.
So was that during the time when Hillsong was kind of changing the game as far as production value? Were you touring with a Christian artist at the same time?
I wasn't necessarily touring with any one artist. I was doing spot dates with different artists. But yeah, Hillsong was killing it, dude. This was around the era of like Mighty to Save.
I mean, they destroyed it. I mean, yeah, that was every other song. Like I used to play in worship bands too, and it was like every other song.
Almost definitely.
All with that driving kick.
You had Mighty to Save. Four on the floor all day. Yeah.
I used to laugh by myself when worship leaders, it's like, it was no surprise. We would like start practicing and they're like, all right. So for the drums, can you just kind of do like a driving kick for this one? And it would be like six songs in a row. And I'd be like, yeah, dude, I'm just going to do that the whole time.
Yeah, and like I'm not gonna lie, man, that still gets to me because like I in modern worship music, you know, I can't really speak for most drummers, but for me, man, like I'm doing one of like three beats, maybe four, and it always like suits the song. It's just like the songs are kind of all written like that. And at that time, it was, you know, Glorious Day.
Yep,
you had Mighty to Save. You had anthem bangers, you know, and so it was a lot of really serious driving stuff, tribal toms on the bridge, yep, kind of thing, you know, down chorus, big outro.
I mean, it's basically like it's almost like a scientific method because it appeases like certain physiological, like it gives the listener like some kind of physiological feeling, kind of like EDM music. It's like the reason EDM music is all the same is because the science matters. It's like you have a buildup and then you have a drop and your body loves hearing the drop. And then you build up and then you drop and then you change it, do a key change, another buildup, another drop. And it's basically like what worship music is too.
Yeah. And you know, I'll say that now, man, like I definitely feel like there's a formula that a lot of worship leaders stick to now. And I'm not sure if it's a good thing. I'm not sure if it's a bad thing, but it's definitely something that they've found that works.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to stray that formula.
Yeah. I get it though, because you have to appeal to such a massive crowd and like get them to participate. So I assume you're having to, if you try to switch things up and do something completely out of left field, people are going to be like, what is this?
Yeah, totally. And I get that, you know, it's weird, man. Like I had a really great conversation with a worship leader who I was filling in at his church a few weeks back. And he was just like, yeah. And he was just basically sharing with me about his experience with becoming a worship leader and then in eventually becoming on staff at the church he was at. And he was, you know, he was kind of telling me how he had to pick and choose different songs to deal with different situations. Like, you know, one week the worship pastor might say, the pastor might say, you know what, I'm really kind of feeling just acoustic guitar and voices this week. And so he has to make the changes and, you know, make the proper arrangements, let other musicians that were slated to play know, let other ones come in who are, you know, better at doing like the kind of light, airy singing versus like the bigger, like anthematic type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot that goes in, you know, both being a worship leader and a pastor are very, very difficult jobs.
Yeah, they are. And they don't pay much at all. Unless you're an artist. I would assume.
Right.
I haven't seen any of these W-2s.
Well, and even then though, you know, it depends. Like if you're on staff with a church, I mean, if you write a song for them, is that just part of your pay? Like, you know, like mm-hmm. Those are things that I think a lot of churches are kind of having to deal with now, you know?
Oh, as far as like the licensing agreements and stuff?
Right, right. Like, is it the church's property once it's written by you because you're on staff with them? Or is that your thing that's separate?
Yeah, oof, it seems dicey. So
it's greasy for sure.
What about moving? Like, so you did some of the Christian sit-ins and stuff. Now you're in Nashville. What brought you there and what are you up to now?
I had gotten married and my wife and I had just kind of been chilling in Tulsa. You know, I to be perfectly honest with you, my heart wasn't in the city anymore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know where it was at, but I felt like I had one foot out the door. And, you know, I was like, you know, maybe LA, maybe New York, but I don't have a thick enough skin to live on the coast, bro. Like, it freaked me out. And then I was like, well, I think we have actually even considered Kansas City for a second there. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
But then we started to look at Nashville and I started to realize I knew quite a few people that were already there. Mm-hmm. And then we went to go visit my Noah. Do you remember Pillar?
Yeah.
Christian rock band. Yeah. So we went and stayed at Noah's house with him and his wife and their kiddos for like a week.
That's cool.
And we fell in love with the city. And then like, we were like, all right, we need to freaking do this. So at the time I was filling in for a buddy of mine on tour and I had a week off in between runs. So I just stayed in Nashville and my wife was sending me all these like addresses to go check out. And Nashville, for those of you that don't know how big it is pretty freaking big. Mm-hmm. Like Nashville, the actual city is not that big, but like all the surrounding towns around it that make up the greater Nashville area is massive.
Yeah.
And she was sending me like 20 miles in this direction, 15 miles back. And finally I was like, honey, I'll just pick a spot. I'm signing off. And then I found us an apartment. And so we moved out here and we've been out here 7 years this November.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Do you have any kiddos or any pups or anything?
We do. We have we call him our oldest son, our dog Max. He'll be 8 he just turned 8. And then my oldest son is 4.5. And then my youngest son is almost 10 months.
Whew.
Which is crazy.
So you got your hands full with some parenting going on.
I got some babies. Yes. Which, I mean, dude, I love being a dad. You know, it probably has something to do with being raised by a single mom. Like, I always knew, I was like, man, if I ever freaking have kids, I'm just going to try my hardest to be like the best freaking dad.
Yeah.
So now I get to do all the fun stuff that I didn't get to experience, you know, which is, I get emotional all the time with my kids just because I'm like, man, you don't know how awesome this is. Like, I know I'm probably a really corny dad, but to me, you know, it's like I got to take my oldest son fishing like a month ago. And like, we got up early, we got donuts. And like, that was freaking huge for me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he really got that much out of it, but I know I loved it.
That's amazing though. Like, what a way to use your upbringing for good. Like, it's incredibly sad to not have a father in your life, but to be able to turn it around and say, look, I'm about to love the hell out of my kids because
for sure,
my pops,
you know,
wasn't
and
involved.
Man, you know, and it's something that I'm constantly trying to remind myself of. It's just like, man, okay, look, you know, he's not going to want to hang out with you all the time. And it's like, so I try to like be mindful of that too. Cause he constantly reminds me, he's like, mommy's my favorite. Like, he lets me know, like, he's like, could you get mommy to come in here? Cause she's my favorite. And I'm like, okay, well, that doesn't hurt at all. But dude, it's great. You know, I there's this amazing flat parking lot at this church down the street from my house. Shout out to Pastor Doug. Basically, like, my wife and I and our kids, we were walking by, and I have a longboard skateboard, and my son has a tricycle. And I was like, oh, that is the smoothest cement for, like, miles. So we went there one day, and I was like, I was fully thinking we were going to get kicked out. Pastor Doug rolled up and was like, is this your car? I was like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. You know, like, I know we're not members. I'm really sorry. Like, I don't mean to trespass. We'll leave. He's like, no, it's totally cool, man. And like, I was actually really taken back by like how cool he was.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a lot of places they're like, no, trespassing, get the frick off. You know, you're not a member. And he instead was like, oh man, you know, like, you know, your dad, like, he wanted to know about me and my family. And he's like, man, I'm you know, dude, be here as much as you want to. I'm glad to see you're out here doing the dad thing. And I'm like, man, that, you know, that meant a lot.
That's legit. And y'all were just cutting it up on the pavement there.
We were literally going from one end to the other and giggling. Like, it was so simple. He chases me, and then I let him catch me, and then I chase him, and I let him barely, you know, evade me. Like, that's what we do. And it's so goofy, and it's just so fun.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't really think it was going to be that great, and, like, we have a blast.
That's legit.
It's so much fun.
Shout out to Pastor Doug. Sounds like a good dude.
Pastor Doug's great. Oh, man, he's great. You know, he was like, yeah, come back anytime. Play in the playground. We'd love to have you, you know.
It's amazing. Are you a full-time studio musician now, or are you a full-time touring musician?
So I was touring full-time up until about maybe a year and some change ago, and my wife told me she was preggers with our Arthur II, and at the time, to be perfectly honest, she was kind of having a tough go at it. I kind of felt like I was like, okay, I need to get off the road. She needs me at home, and I need to be at home. So I did that. You know, I went from touring full time with like a, you know, bigger country act to, I think I was, you know, selling extra gear and driving for Lyft and, you know, frick, what else was I doing?
Hustling.
I was basically doing anything and everything I could do to make sure that we were okay.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, and so honestly, like, you know, I play quite a bit. I mean, I don't do anything right now other than music. So I'm still full time, but I don't tour. I fill in, I sub at several different churches. I still play between 4 and 5 nights a week.
Oh, snap.
And then I still, yeah.
It's like you're doing what are the weeknight deals that you're doing?
Yeah. It's mostly club gigs just locally around town. I mean, I very rarely play anywhere outside of the greater Nashville
area.
Okay,
so like Broadway type deals?
Yeah, sometimes Broadway, sometimes just kind of like, you know, a tiny little, you know, cafe. I mean, it really just kind of varies. I mean, yeah, I definitely do Broadway for sure. I mean, you know, the for those of you who don't know, Broadway is kind of like our, well, I mean, there's not really anything else like it. You know, like, I guess there's Bourbon Street in New Orleans, Beale Street in Memphis, but, you know, it's basically like that's where all the tourists mm-hmm. go when they come to Nashville. It's like 50 honky-tonks stacked up.
All the live, like, country covers or the up-and-comers trying to make it in Nash. I mean, it's kind of like a necessary evil, right? Like, to play on Broadway. It's probably like the locals probably hate buying into the touristy piece, but I bet it pays better than trying to play elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, do you want to really play for a bunch of drunk tourists and pretend like you can't wait to play their favorite, you know, song again for the 100th time or the 1,000th time? But at the end of the day, it's like, man, like, you know, 4 hours of this equals, you know, a day and a half's pay for a lot of jobs. So you can't be too bitter.
Yeah, and keeping it in perspective, you get to play there music for money, which is beats working.
Right. And thankfully, most of those clubs actually have house kits, so I don't have to bring my own drum kit.
Because that's where all the labor comes, right? Yeah. Like, if you're already practiced up and you can, quote-unquote, plug and play, the pain of it is lugging the drums to and from.
For sure. And, like, you know, I still have homies that have to take their kits with them everywhere. And I'm like, gosh.
And then you're like, if you don't have good cases, you're destroying your kit in the process. And then, it's a whole thing.
Exactly.
So that's awesome that you're able to make a full career out of playing drums. Because a lot of people would like to do that and they're not doing it. But it sounds like, you know, you were hungrier and it's more of a hustle play. Like, granted, I've watched your stuff on YouTube and you do have chops, and I would encourage people to look up your videos on YouTube. If you just look up Ben Satterly with two T's.
Two T's, for sure.
One thing I wanted to ask is, I looking through your Instagram, you kind of mentioned a couple of times, like, using your music as a tool to influence others. So I guess I wanted to ask, how has your faith played a role in all of that? Because it would be very easy to just be focused on drums and not be considered, or not considering your talents and how to influence others with that. But could you talk me through some of that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I've been really fortunate. It's been interesting because it's like, I didn't get on Instagram to get, like 1,000,000 followers mm-hmm. or anything like that. I just kind of was just like, hey, this is a cool way to network. And then I started to just say, like, well, I don't really have a website. So it'd be kind of cool to be able to show some of what I do. Within the last like year or two, I've had a really love-hate relationship with social media in general. And I'm only on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I'm not on Facebook or Twitter. And there are some days where I'm like, I just delete Instagram. I deleted it for about a week because I just needed a break. Like, I just was like, okay, God, I just need to be a break.
Yeah.
I need to be
away. Because it can get real addicting.
All the distractions. And other, oh my gosh. Well, the studies are starting to come out about how detrimental to our minds that social media is. And especially in like the younger generation. Like, I grew up without cell phone. You know, like, I didn't mm-hmm. have one until I was 19. So for me, it's a relatively newer thing, you know. But to answer your question about, you know, how my faith is, you know, coming to play, when you go to my profile, the very first thing that it says about me is talks about me being a Christian. It doesn't say I'm a drummer as the first thing, because that's what I want people to know about first. It says imperfect, flawed, saved. Like, that is me summed up. And, I've been really fortunate, man, because I have Christians that follow me. Obviously, I also have Jews that follow me. I have a large following in the Middle East,
really?
Oddly enough. I get messages all the time from guys that barely speak English and that are always very like uplifting. They're like, "Hey, I just love what you do." And then I see the page, and you know, they're from, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq, or it's really, really interesting how social media can like do that. But like a few days ago, actually, I was at this gig and this dude showed up and he was like, "Ben freaking Satterly." He didn't say freaking, he said the other word. But he walked up to me and I was like, hey, brother. I call everyone brother because I get approached a lot and oftentimes I don't know who they are. So I just say, hey, brother, because I like the intimacy of it. because it's just like, you know, it automatically breaks down like barriers. It's like, hey, brother, how are you, man? I call everyone brother. But he was like, man, I've been a fan of yours for like 2 or 3 years. And he had big, huge pentagrams in his ears. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I guess he's actually like more, I'm not sure if he's full on Satanist, but he's definitely an atheist. But he came up with like a beer, and he's like, I know you don't drink. And I'm like, how do you know I don't drink? But he's like, man, can I get you something? I was like, yeah, dude, a Dr. Pepper would be great. And we talked for a few minutes after the gig was over, and he kind of shared with me how he'd moved to town and was doing his thing. And I was like, man, this is so wild. Like, not only was he really, really respectful, but he something I've done resonated with him enough for him to want to interact with me. And like, it really just made me feel good. I'm like, okay, well, maybe I am doing something worth it.
Yeah, and so y'all were able to connect over drums. That's interesting that you don't drink being in the music business, like even in the Christian music business. Was that a personal decision you made a long time ago?
So I can judge people. No, not at all. No, honestly, like when I turned 21, I tried like a little bit of everything. And I said, okay, look, liquor. This is, you know, this is whiskey. This is bourbon. This is blah. And none of it tasted really good to me, except for like Boone's Farm or like Smirnoff. Like the stuff that didn't count as liquor anyways. So I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna sit this one out, you know? And so I just decided I'm not gonna drink. And it is definitely not like a judgmental thing. It's like I got no beef with anyone that drinks. I don't smoke either, you know, anything. And I got dreads, so like I get asked if I
mean, yeah, constantly. You're the more likely contact, right? If people are trying to approach someone cold turkey about drugs.
Oh dude, yeah. They know I'm holding. Oh yeah, they know I'm holding always. And it's like I'm like, no, man.
Let me tell you about Jesus.
Sorry, you know. The funny thing is, man, especially like when I'm at like bars, man, like I get asked about Jesus a lot, or like it's so weird, and I think it's just because, you know, with liquor, it, you know, it lowers your inhibitions and it makes you want to, I guess just talk about whatever's really on your heart, you know, whether you're in love or you got hurt or whatever. Man, people love talking about religion when they're drunk.
That's so interesting. So in that regard, you've toured with a lot of bands. I guess my first question is, do you have a favorite band that you toured with or a favorite touring experience?
Favorite band would be really, really hard. I was really close with like the Locash guys. Yeah. Those guys were great. Favorite experience would definitely be, so you know the band Sugarland?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're a
country fan or not. Okay, yeah, so they had this song called Baby Girl. And my favorite experience ever touring, hands down, was I remember I was 19 and I was riding my bicycle back from work, back to my home in Tulsa, back when I didn't have a car. And I heard this song on the radio, and it basically the premise is it's a girl writing to her parents asking for money. She's struggling, but she's doing okay because she's following her dreams. And then the chorus is, "Dear mom and dad, please send money."
Oh, so yeah,
it ain't funny.
And then it changes.
And then the final final chorus goes, "Dear mom and dad, I'll send money. I'm so rich, it ain't funny." And basically, the line that always resonated with me was just, you know, was basically like, you know, being able to reach your dreams. Well, cut to, I guess it would have been 8 or 9 years later, I'm performing with the guy that wrote that song in my hometown in a club that my mom's in attendance for. And I get to sing that song, dear mom and dad, please send money. I'm so broke, it ain't funny. And it goes, please don't worry because I'm all right because I'm playing here in the club tonight. And for some reason, that line just gutted me in that moment. And my mom, she's even more emotional than I was, it was pin drop when I heard, and that was my mom up in the balcony. And I couldn't get through the lyric, man. You know, I was crying. I was, you know, and I told Christian, who was the guy that wrote it, he was the man from Sugarland. I said, man, you just gave me like the best gift ever. Thank you so much for the opportunity to not only just to get to play and sing, you know, BGVs for you, but also to get to do that in front
of That's amazing. And making me feel freaking emotional.
Yeah, so that was, that was definitely
that today.
Oh, you're crying.
That's sweet. I assumed you were going to say playing in front of some like massive crowd, but that's such a better answer to the question.
Hey, yo, what up? This episode of the Preachers and Seekers podcast is brought to you by Rejuvenator Shoe Care. If you're like me and only have a few pairs of kicks, you got to be keeping those fresh at all times. My favorite pair of sneaks are my triple wide Ultra Boost, and they're an absolute dirt magnet. But Rejuvenator provides everything I could possibly need to keep those kicks mega clean and at a reasonable price. All my listeners can get 10% off their whole order by using the code PREACHERS at checkout. So check them out at rejuvenator.com and be sure to use the code PREACHERS for 10% off.
All right. So you're in, you've very much been in the whole music scene, and I'm sure you've experienced some of this kind of celebrity church culture and like building wealth in the Christian space. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you thought just of the whole concept of, is there an issue with preachers wearing expensive sneakers? And then maybe more in the realm of, what do you think about getting rich in the Christian industry?
All right. I want to preface all this with saying that I grew up very, very poor in a time where the prosperity gospel was really, really killing. And so I remember my mom, you know, digging deep always to give. I remember stealing from the offering plate from the 9 a.m. service so I could give it at the 11 a.m. service. Because in my, you know, childlike faith, I was thinking, well, God's going to see that I don't have money, but I got this money so I can give it back. And he's going to honor that, right? Like, you know, cause that's where my mind and my heart were at. You know, I was believing for everything. You know, I grew up very, very poor, and, you know, we were having to believe that God was going to provide. And I remember times where my mom was, you know, scrubbing floors for wealthy people, and they would leave extra money for like a Christmas present for me, or we'd be at the bank and somebody would walk up and say, God just told me to give you whatever's in this wallet and in this envelope. And it was like $100, or, somebody would buy us a fridge because our old fridge broke, and then they filled it with groceries for us. I mean, like that stuff happened all the time while my mom was going to Bible school. So I have a very love-hate relationship with when people talk about money. And for a lot of years, I really had issues with people that were wealthy because I grew up with such a lack that I held, you know, animosity towards them. I don't anymore, thankfully. I've been like delivered to that. I don't feel that way. But as far as pastors, and I guess in extension, like worship leaders becoming really, really wealthy and flaunting their wealth, I don't agree with it to an extent, and I'll explain what that extent is. Basically, I have a problem with people using the pulpit or an extension like the stage as a billboard. It is a platform, and that's literally what it is. The stage is the platform. The pulpit is the centerpiece of the platform. What I say by billboard is making themselves stand out for wearing very, very expensive clothing, very, very expensive watches, expensive shoes, all that stuff. And then trying to say, oh, well, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with being blessed. Blessed is a state of mind. Blessed isn't just materialism. And so with the increase in the popularity of the prosperity message, a lot of people have bought into the non-biblical idea that in order to be in God's favor, in order to be in God's good graces, you have to never, ever be sick and have an overabundance of material wealth. You know, I was talking about this with my wife a couple of days ago. A lot of the people on your page, man, you know, they're decked out head to toe in really nice clothes. And I have no beef with nice clothing. I personally don't like brands at all. You won't see a logo on any of my clothes because I just don't care about that. A lot of these brands like Supreme or Gucci, or which I know nothing about these brands. It is purely about clout. It has zero to do with comfort. I mean, I refuse to believe that a $2,000 pair of pants feels that much better than like just a good quality pair of pants because they have a brand logo.
What if they're gifted? Does it matter? Like,
well, okay, so let's talk about that. So if they're gifted, that is one thing different. But even still, I think these people, these men and women, need to be mindful of the perception of them going out of their way so much to be seen in these, basically, like they're just trappings, bro. Like, because none of this really matters. Like, wearing head to toe Gucci or wearing, you know, $1,000 shoes doesn't make your message resonate with me.
Yeah.
More. You know, and then say, like, well, what happens if they get them for free or if they have like an endorsement? Like, I have endorsements with companies because I like what the products that they make are. Like, you know, with the cymbal company I play, it's because I like the sound of those cymbals. Now, if you put me on another drum kit, I'm still going to sound like myself, regardless if I have my own gear or not. But one of the issues that we run into is with a lot of these pastors and worship leaders, you don't see them separated from the gear. You know, their gear being the expensive clothing. They go out of their way to be seen wearing these things.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I don't know if any of them, I've yet to see if anyone is actually getting gifted things to wear from an endorsement perspective. I know they're getting gifted things from people that appreciate them, or maybe brands are gifting it to them, but I've yet to see if it's actually happening. It's interesting to kind of sit in the tension of, like, what are we to do with that if that is in fact happening? Like, should we care that something other than the gospel is being projected from a massive platform like that?
Right. And you know, like, the thing is, I mean, if you feel like you want to rock a brand, that's totally fine. But I guess the issue that I run into with a lot of these pastors, and they're really celebrity pastors, because most pastors don't make that much money. So when we, you know, so the people that are featured on your page are celebrity pastors. And like, usually that goes part and parcel with a certain quality of living, a certain quality of clothing, a certain look. You know, they all have a brand. And like, I guess I'm sick and tired of seeing these pastors go to such great lengths to portray this lifestyle of, I mean, really it's excess, man. A lot of these guys are living in multi-million dollar mansions, multiple cars, really, really expensive clothing. And it's like, man, here's the thing. If you want to rock brands, why don't you rock like a To Write Love on Her Arms shirt or Triple X Church, something that's actually doing something for the kingdom, bro. Like, you rocking a Supreme outfit, which, I mean, when Supreme first came out, I thought it was brand-based. I didn't realize, like, the branding looked like Colgate to me. So I was like, wow, these people really dig, you know, dental hygiene. And then I come to find out it's like a multi-million dollar.
It's a very dad brand. Take for you to like, make on Supreme.
I know. I'm such a cornball. But, you know, it's weird, man. Celebrity pastors, to me, they just have this swag to them that just says, I have wealth, I have influence. And neither of which are really that important to being a pastor.
Do you think, though, there's merit to dressing like the people they're trying to reach?
No, because I believe that I guess you could put it like this. Like when Paul was saying, like, I'm a Roman to the Romans, I'm a Jew to the Jews, like, be all things to all people. I completely dig that, you know. At the same time, there's something so disingenuous about luring people in with, clothing and then hoping and praying that they're going to stay there because they just think you know, like. It's because it's so not important. You know, there's this amazing quote by this guy named Scott Sauls. I know nothing about him. He could be a horrible person, but I think he's actually a really nice guy. The quote is, pastors impacted by the gospel step up to the pulpit to preach with a limp, not a swag.
Hmm.
And When I read that quote, I got goosebumps, bro. That it gutted me for like a week. And you know, especially like in this day and age where we have shows like The Righteous Gemstones, like kind of making fun at like the over the top lifestyle that a lot of these pastors enjoy. I guess I'm really tired of seeing these pastors with a freaking smile on their face all the time. Yeah. Like they don't struggle with
stuff. It is tough because they're definitely curating their image for sure. They've got a lot of creative teams behind them. I guess I don't blame them for doing that, but it does send a message that everything is peachy. But I guess that's what most of us are doing on Instagram too. What do you think that quote means? Like,
well, which is why I'm one of the first people to. Before I forget it, that's one of the reasons why I'm always saying that social media is a freaking lie. You're always putting your best foot forward. So when somebody says, "Oh man, it seems like you always have it all together," I'll be the first one to correct them. Like, absolutely not. In fact, you know, I was very upfront about my struggles mm-hmm. with depression. I don't know if you personally knew Pastor Jared. I didn't know him. Jared Wilson.
I spoke with him over DMs a few times. We didn't meet in person, but we met over Instagram.
He was the pastor that took his life mm-hmm. a couple weeks ago. And I didn't know him. And like, I started reading about him and like, man, his life and what he did resonated so much with me. You know, he had a wife and two boys, just like, you know, I did. He struggled with, negative thoughts. And he was suicidal, just like I was for some reason he decided that he just couldn't go mm-hmm. on. He ended his life. And it really sent me down this trail of prayer and reflection, not just for him and his family, but for a lot of these pastors. And I started to think of these people in these positions of power in the church in a way that I had never really felt before. And I felt sorry for them. I felt worried for them because it's really easy to criticize about, you know, the decadent lifestyles that a lot of these people live and, you know, the smiles that they always seem to have on their faces. And it made me start to think, like, what if these men and women struggled not only with their own personal demons, but then they struggle with knowing what to say and how to say to their, you know, their congregation, to their flock, to these people, because they're supposed to have all the answers. And when you don't, you know, it's really easy to lose sight of what's important. It's really easy to lose sight of yourself. You know, I started reading statistics about pastors. It was something. It was like over 50% have had a negative. Over 50% of pastors since taking a pastoral position has had a negative effect on their family. Over 50% of pastors, it was much higher, have struggled with depression and anxiety, and had struggles dealing with the pressures of being in a position of authority within the body of Christ. That was one thing that, like, man, I wanted to come on this podcast with like war paint on. I was ready to go in on these dudes. And although I definitely don't agree with the prosperity mm-hmm. message, because to teach people that their sickness or their current financial circumstances is based purely on their faith or lack of, that's not biblical. Because there's an amazing quote. It was said, like, if God's, I'm paraphrasing, and I suck at direct quotes, so I always have to paraphrase. It was basically, if God's blessing on your life is dictated by never going through struggles and always having health and always having wealth, then he hated the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just so true because, you know, when he was writing all those amazing books to the different churches that were getting started, he was chained and he was in prison, you know, and he was probably beaten and half starved. And, you know, those were the people that were at the beginning. I mean, like, I love the book of Acts because that was what the church was, it was always the people. It was never these mega multi-million-dollar stadiums that we call churches. That was never the church. The church was always the people. And you know, when these men and women that were going out in the name of Jesus, man, you know, struggling and getting beaten, and many of them were martyred. I mean, you know, 11 of the 13 apostles were martyred. John was exiled to the Isle of Patmos, where he died of old age, allegedly, and Judas killed himself. But all the others were martyred, you know. And these were men that right. knew Jesus. But now with the prosperity gospel, we're being told, oh yeah, you know, dig deeper, give more, and you know, you want that healing? How bad you want it, you know? Or if you're struggling financially, if you're not able to buy these clothes, or if you're able to put food on the table, you don't have enough faith. And she's like, how do you say something like that to a single mom who's struggling, yeah. you know, cleaning floors, or working two and three jobs? Like, I don't have enough gall to right. say something like that. And these men and women do with a straight face. You know, there was a there was a pastor you featured on your page not too long ago, Mike Todd, who I actually grew up
with. Oh, yeah. With.
And I guess one of his the newest, I guess you would say, like, a conference he had was called "What You Have Is All You Need" or something like
that. Oh yeah, I saw that around the picture or something that I used.
Yeah, and I was like, man, what you have is all I need. and you know,
I'm apparently a good drummer too, right?
Mike and his family were always. Man, he was such a good drummer. We grew up together, and he was one of those dudes that if he would have stuck with it and didn't get so involved with all this church business, he could have really done something great. But man, you know, I'm so happy that he's gone on to do a lot of the stuff he's done. Another guy I knew that you've featured on your page was Sean Foyt. I played with him with this thing called The Burn, which he helped start, which was this national worship movement. You got to do a podcast interview with him, because I'd love to hear what that dude's been up to. I know he's
one of the lead guys at Bethel, music wise. I've been meaning to get him on. I tried to get him when he came to Dallas, but he was super busy, obviously. And I'm planning on getting him on at some point. He's hilarious.
Oh man, he's a good one to do to have on there, because he always had a really great take and a really great heart for God. But you know, it's just. All of this to say, man, like, you know, when you talk about the pressures that these men and women face, man, like, I often wonder, like, is our infatuation with material wealth and perception influencing a lot of these quote unquote celebrity pastors to act a certain way?
I mean, yeah, because I mean, the onus is on a lot of us, because inherently, the things that we as random people care about are going to project on how we see church. And ultimately we've created a lot of this mega celebrity church world. So I guess I don't necessarily blame. I guess the question is, like, what do we expect from them? If they're great communicators, they have a heart for God, and they're also good leaders. They're building a massive church through doing a lot of things really well. I guess my question for the whole thing is, like, what do we expect? Or, like, are we to stifle some dude's growth because he's getting too big or he's getting too popular? I don't know. It's an interesting problem. Or I don't know if it's a problem, but it's an interesting thing to think about. And a lot of people feel strongly about it.
Like, you know, I was looking up different pastors last night, and, you know, like, one was Francis Chan, who gave away, like, most of his he gave away, like, most of his material possessions, and I think he basically, like, you know, he stepped down from his church. He was like, you guys run it, I don't want anymore, and he moved to another community. Another one was Rick Warren, man. Like, both of those guys are I think you could definitely say that they're celebrity pastors, but both of those guys are guys who do not harp on materialism. I mean, you know, Rick Warren lives on the reverse tithe. He gives away 90%, lives on the 10. But he's also lived in the same home for 20 plus years. He buys his watches at Walmart. Like, I mean, it's like, so it's like, well, yeah, I mean, like this guy, he wrote Purpose Driven Life, bro. The second most, you know, the second best selling book ever, except for the Bible. Like, I can't even imagine how much money that guy has gone through. But he's like, there was this amazing quote. He's like, I just started rejecting money because I didn't want people to think I was in this for the money. I'm in this because I love Jesus.
Dang.
And I'm like, God, say that, bro.
That's convicting. Say that. Because that, I mean, that applies to all of us, really. It's like, if we're truly in it to live for Jesus, maybe we should be all living like that. But I don't really want to give away 90% of what I'm making, real talk.
I would starve if I gave away 90% of what I'm making, bro. I got kids and a dog, man. You know, but no, it's interesting because it's like, you know, when you look back to John the Baptist, who I would definitely say was the first celebrity pastor, man. He lived out on the fringes of society. People came to him, and they, you know, the teachers of the law at the time were like, "So are you the Messiah?" He's like, "No." Like, "Well, are you Elijah?" "No." "Well, who are you?" He's like, "I'm a voice in the wilderness, crying out, prepare the way of the Lord." And then when Jesus came, he started, you know, taking his followers, you know. And when they asked him, like, "Aren't you angry?" He's like, "No, you know, I must decrease so that he may increase." Like, he took all the steps of his life with such a level of grace. And I want to see more of that in the church leaders now. I don't see a lot of these men and women trying to decrease themselves. I see a lot of these men and women trying to increase their platform, increase their influence. And I'm not saying that the platform is wrong in and of itself, but when you're propping yourself up rather than Jesus, that's when the issue comes into play. When you're propping up the importance of materialism and the importance of, you know, faith will equal all this other stuff, it doesn't add up.
Yeah, you know, a lot of them aren't audibly saying that. Like, a lot of them, the very few, other than like the OG prosperity gospel dudes, are actually saying today, like, give more and you'll receive more, or like, have more faith and you'll get more blessed. It's more, it toes the line between like self-help and motivation type. Like, that's where I think we get in trouble more often than bona fide prosperity gospel messages. More of like, hey, you, because I'm a great communicator, I'm going to encourage you to go out and achieve your dreams and get through the hard stuff and, you know, get out of your current situation, instead of anchoring it all to the gospel and say, look, you need Jesus regardless of where you're at. And he died a terrible death to pay for the sins that you're always going to have, versus like, hey, if you just hunker down, keep persevering, keep coming to listen to these motivating messages, you'll get through it. I think it seems dangerous to build your platform off that message versus off of something like, look, you need to read the Bible and understand that Jesus is the only way.
Right. And I think I'm just getting sick and tired of getting basically a watered down, you know, self-help motivational type thing, man. I just want Jesus, man. Like, I don't, and like, this is a weird thing for a worship guy to say, cause I love worship. I don't like a lot of the worship music that's out. But like, I do love worshiping. Is that like, if you took all the stuff away from these guys, would their message be as resonant with some of their, you know, community? If you took, you know, the trappings away from Olsteen's church, you know, if you took the fog machines out, you know, if you broke down the Crystal Cathedral, like, if you, you know, like, it's just like, you take all the extra stuff away, all the extraneous stuff away. If they can still preach Jesus loves you wearing just some regular clothes, then awesome, more power to them. But I'm sick of feeling like they have to be this certain thing, hit all these points. Yeah. And like, you know, a lot of the pastors that you feature on the page, man, it's like they all kind of dress the same. They all kind of look the same. And it's very much a self-gratifying lifestyle. you know, that they're able to justify all the stuff that they do by saying, well, I've been very blessed. Cool. That's awesome. You know, I too have been very blessed. I think our views of what means to be blessed are very different though.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily dictate blessings by material stuff.
Yeah. I mean, because ultimately the blessing is getting to be connected with God eternally.
Right. Right.
And then having the blessing of being able to live for him and not being condemned for the rest of your life.
For sure. Like, yeah, you know, are you able to continue on preaching if your flock dwindles, if the money isn't there? Because, and that's another thing, man. Like, I don't know if I have the grace to be a pastor, bro. To be perfectly honest with you, like the amount of crap that they have to deal with is insane.
Yeah, it's a tough job. I don't really understand why people sign up to do it at this point. Like, just knowing what actually goes into it. I mean, I do know why. Like, a lot of people are like, I want to follow Jesus and I feel called to do this, but it seems freaking hard and thankless, and there's not really a stopping point.
I would definitely say you could be in it for the money, because I think there are, not a lot, but I think there are definitely some people that are in for the money. But I think a lot of people, you know, that who even, let's say, even the ones that would, I guess you could say they've kind of fallen away or gone astray or led people astray, I think they absolutely went into it with the best of intentions. And, you know, man, there was this amazing quote that Pastor Rick Warren said about his son. It was basically like, in the garden of God's grace, even a broken tree can bear fruit. And these men and women, man, they're deeply flawed individuals. And this isn't a dig. This is a fact. I don't wish ill on any of these people. I want them to have, you know, a good life, and I want them to be blessed. I need people to hear that your life isn't dictated by your faith solely, in that if you get sick, it wasn't because you believed enough. If you don't have enough money, right, it wasn't because you believed enough. Could you say that to somebody in a third world country, you know, who's living on a dirt floor? It's like, and especially that, if you were to go to a place like where they're at, if I go to a metal show and I'm wearing like a FUBU tracksuit, I'm going to stand out like a sore freaking thumb. I think we need people that are a little bit more flexible, that are able to go into those places and say, you know what, like, I'm going to go to where you are just as I am to talk to you just as you are. Because let me tell you something, Jesus loves you, brother. And, you know, and I think that's what we need. You know, Jesus said it to his disciples, and like, this is the quote of all quotes. He's like, you know, you in this life, you will have troubles. They'll persecute you like they persecuted me. Like, he promised them that life was going to suck at times. You know, but then we have to go also to the consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials and tribulations.
Right.
You know, I don't consider it pure joy when I can't pay a bill. I don't consider it pure joy when the car breaks down for the thousandth time. But I tell you what, man, God's been doing a work in me and a work in my wife's heart where, I tell you, man, you know, life is not easy right now. We just got denied a loan for a home. And we were like, Lord, if this is your will, make it happen. And we got back a heck no. We thought this was amazing. But through it all, man, like, God's been just, I've been so fortunate to get to, he's working on my heart in the meantime to be able to deal with the punches and roll with them, you know, and just go like, you know, like this whole thing, this whole life, man, is just a freaking vapor. And then we move on to the next thing. And so like, so yeah, although this life would be nice, it'd be nice to have a freaking tub that I could fit in or, you know, my wife's AC not freaking being on the fritz all the time, but at the same time, like, I'm so hopeful for what God's doing in the body of Christ and what he's putting into the hearts of young men and women that are growing up. And that, and I really feel like God's about to do like an amazing move where he's going to take people from all different walks of life and get them out there. Like, I'm praying for Marilyn Manson.
Yeah,
I want that dude badly. Can I tell you a quick story about Manson real quick? Yeah. Yeah, I went to a concert with a buddy of mine from church. He was like, "You want to go to Manson?" I was like, "Yes." And there's a scene, there's a song that he does where he rips out a Bible. He rips it apart and he sets it on fire. And this whole time I was standing there, like I was watching all these people smiling, and then they were, you know, getting really into it. I met a lot of them. They were super nice. I was actually wearing a church shirt, and I didn't plan it. I just happened to be wearing a church shirt. I was like, "Oh, that's right. I'm going to a Manson show." And I kept waiting for the dark anointing to hit and the feeling of the demonic. And instead I was praying for him. It was the weirdest thing. I was just going like, "Man, God," like, cause I read his biography, and one of the things he talked about was like, he got so sick and tired of people saying that he was the devil. He's like, "Fine, you want me to be the devil? I'll show you the devil." And that's when he really started amping it up.
Yeah.
And my heart just broke, man. You know, like I think we need to be praying for people like that. You know, these people that are struggling with whatever, they still have a massive influence and a massive fan base. And it's like, imagine if a dude like Marilyn Manson came to Christ, or a dude like Eminem came to Christ. Like, imagine how gnarly that would be, bro?
And he's got the power to do it. I mean, we put God in a very small box, but ultimately he's going to do exactly what he's going to do. Yeah, for sure. Well, I love your heart behind that. And it's convicting to me. Like, I should be praying for people that I want to critique a lot more than I do currently. And I think it's something that we, as believers, we should all do. And yeah, I just think that's so important. I know we're well over time, but I really appreciate your insights on this. And it's good to get a perspective of somebody that's grown up with the situation that you grew up in. I'm trying to get diverse perspectives on what materialism looks like and what we are to do with celebrity church culture, because I don't really know what to do with it. But I, for whatever reason, this is a tension that people are sitting in right now. And I'm happy to get people that have some great insight into it. And I think people will get a lot out of our conversation, mostly from what you said, nothing from what I said. So,
man,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, man, like I want to thank you so much for allowing me to be on this thing. And you know, I definitely know that the page is, it's been divisive, but it's a conversation that's been happening for a long, long time. And I hope it continues to open up a more open and honest dialogue about the current state of affairs within the church, and allows to discuss civilly, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. If people want to rebuke you online, where can they find you?
I'm going to tell you right now, man, if anybody messages me on Instagram and wants to do a debate, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to be like, all right, I'm going to straight up tell you, man, I just don't care enough. And it's not that I'm trying to be mean or negative. Dude, half these people on your page, I've never even heard of. Because my sphere of influence that I allow into my life to influence me is very, very small. I try to be very selective about that. So at the same time, it's like, I'm very particular about who I let in, and I don't allow negativity into my life if I can help it. So if anyone wants to just kind of talk, I'm totally down with that. I am Ben Satterlee, Satterlee, on Instagram. So Instagram/ I am Ben Satterlee.
Sweet, man. All right, Ben Satterlee, drummer/ philosopher based in Nashville. Thanks for your time, brother, and hope we can do this again, man.
Oh, absolutely, bro. Anytime. Thanks so much, man.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
All right, brother. Bye.
Hey, y'all, I really appreciate you checking out the Preachers and Sneakers podcast. If you haven't already, please make sure you rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts as well as Spotify. Also, if you haven't checked us out on Instagram, we're always posting at @PreachersNSneakers. And again, if you haven't checked out the Patreon, please head over there, patreon.com/preachersandsneakers. There you get to support the pod. Everything we're doing at Preachers and Sneakers, we've got a lot of awesome content coming soon. So please keep an eye out. And thanks again, as always, for listening to the Preachers and Sneakers podcast. Thanks again for listening to the Preachers and Sneakers podcast. Our intro and ad music was by our good friend Wordsplayed. You can follow him on Instagram @Wordsplayed. And also thank you to our audio engineer, Zane Callister, for making my voice sound way better than it actually is in real life.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.